This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Today, evicted farmers in Myanmar rarely receive anything close to market rates as compensation, if they are compensated at all. A few months ago, the government turned off the irrigation pipes that pump water to Al Wan Sak, according to farmers there. Now they are unable to irrigate their rice fields, and some of them are selling off cows and other livestock just to make ends meet. On a recent afternoon, Koai Hete was sitting cross-legged in a wooden hut in the village. He pointed to a pile of recent newspaper clippings.
All the newspapers and magazines are saying that Burma is changing, but the way the officials act, it reminds me of the old way of ruling the people.
The rice farmer says he isn't sure what's in store for him and his neighbors. If they do lose their land, he says, he would at least like to find new rice paddies as quickly as possible. But in today's Myanmar, finding cheap agricultural land on the fringe of Yangon is a very tall order. Mike Ives, FSRN, Al Wan Sak, Myanmar.
This is the first of a two-part series. Tune in to FSRN tomorrow when Mike Ives looks at the challenges and opportunities for Myanmar's increasingly vocal civil society. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Molly Stentz and Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Eder. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can find sights and sounds from FSRN's global reporters. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Boston, I'm Dorian Marina.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. for The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
Do you love listening to KBOO? Want to get involved in the great programming you hear? Become a volunteer. KBOO's volunteer orientation will be Tuesday, August 6th at 6 p.m., located at Southeast 8th and Ankeny in Portland. Questions can be directed to Ani at 503-231-8032, extension 213, or by email at volunteer@kboo.org.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation.
The time is 6:03. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
Welcome to Out Loud, KBOO's Queer News, Culture, and Public Affairs program. My name is Alan. Tonight we're going to take a look back in KBOO's archives and pull out an interesting program on AIDS denialism. It's a maligned, controversial topic in the medical, scientific, and queer community in general. Later in the show, we're going to hear a bit of a song from an artist who will be performing this weekend at the Portland Queer Music Festival. This festival starts Friday at Crush in Southeast Portland, and we'll cap off the hour with the latest installment of This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay news magazine. Stay tuned. We're excited. Tonight we're going to dig into the archives of Out Loud, all the way back to the fall of 2011, when Rebecca Ney was talking with some folks about the topic of AIDS denialism. There is a small movement of folks in this country who question the existence of AIDS and HIV, and question any of the medical evidence for this disease. These folks call themselves AIDS denialists, or they call themselves dissidents or skeptics. So we're going to hear from David Crowe. He's president of an organization called Rethinking AIDS, as well as Brian Foley. He's a scientist with the National Institute of Health and a member of AIDS Truth, which is a website devoted to responding to the claims of these AIDS denialists.
Rethinking AIDS describes itself as a voluntary, open membership association of people who question the, quote, hypothesis that a retrovirus called HIV causes the group of diseases known as AIDS. The group claims that many biochemical scientists now question the so-called hypothesis. Rethinking AIDS is also calling for existing evidence that is contrary to their claims to be reevaluated and is pressing for additional research. David Crowe received his degree in biology and mathematics in 1978 from Lakehead University in Ontario, Canada. He is the president and co-founder of the Alberta Reappraising AIDS Society and the current president of Rethinking AIDS. Crowe says there are primarily two schools of thought among folks who question the mainstream paradigm on HIV and AIDS.
Amongst people who question whether HIV causes AIDS, there's really two, there's a division. There are people like Dr. Peter Duisberg who believe that HIV is a harmless passenger virus, and by that he means that it gets passed from mother to child, it gets passed through blood transfusions, etc., but it doesn't cause any harm. The school that I adhere to recognizes that there's absolutely no evidence that HIV has ever been purified, and without evidence of purification, you really don't know that something exists.
So Crowe questions the actual existence of the human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, which means he also questions the basic premise that HIV causes AIDS. David, what is the cause of AIDS, the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome?
Well, you can't really answer that question unless you ask what AIDS is, and it depends when you ask that question. If you'd asked it in 1981, it would have been PCP pneumonia and Kaposi's sarcoma in a very small number of gay men. If you'd asked it in 1987, it would have been about 30 different diseases, usually with the HIV test, which came out in 1984. But if you asked it after 1993 in America, and only in America, it would be people who had low immune cell counts and a positive HIV test and no disease. And if you asked the question in Africa, they bring out the 1986 Bangui definition, which is based on fever, cough, diarrhea, weight loss, itchy rash, without even an HIV test. So depending on where you are and when you were there, you may have AIDS or not AIDS. And so the cause is the cause of the underlying disease, tuberculosis, cervical cancer, whatever the disease is, there is a cause and probably a separate reason for that cause.
So just to understand where you're coming from, you contend that AIDS has nothing to do with HIV?
Well, HIV has never been purified, and when people say that they are positive for HIV, that doesn't mean anybody's proven that they have HIV in their body. What it means is they have certain antibodies that were shown to be associated with AIDS. So the antibodies were more frequent in people who had the characteristic diseases of AIDS, such as Kaposi's sarcoma and PCP, but nobody ever proved that A, HIV even existed, and B, was the cause of AIDS.
Brian Foley from the National Institute of Health is a scientist with HIV databases at the Los Alamos Laboratory. Foley says that there is conclusive evidence regarding the existence of multiple strains of HIV and that both of them do, in fact, cause AIDS.
The cause of AIDS is HIV-1 or HIV-2. They're two different immunodeficiency viruses. It's a virus, it's a lentivirus, a retrovirus. It's not much different from HTLV or other retroviruses. The procedure for isolating a virus like that is pretty well established, and it's not any different for HIV than it is for any other virus.
For many in the mainstream scientific and medical community, that's the end of the discussion. For them, peer-reviewed scientific studies are conclusive. However, that's not how David Crow sees it. The president of Rethinking AIDS not only denies the existence of HIV, but the peer-reviewed research that says otherwise.
Well, there's actually a peer-reviewed scientific literature on peer review, and it shows that the major benefits of peer review are enforcing a dogma, because the peer reviewers are anonymous, and they're generally not famous scientists, because if they were famous scientists, they'd have better things to do than review grant applications and publications. And so they've learned what they consider to be facts, and they make sure that anybody who comes along with anything completely new and different gets shut down. And there's some really good books and some good scientific articles on peer review, but it's a very flawed process.
While Crow discounts the authenticity of mainstream scientific research on HIV and AIDS, it made me think about the viral load test, which according to Wikipedia measures the severity of a viral infection within an involved body fluid. The viral load test in HIV, according to WebMD, is able to determine the number of copies of the HIV virus in an infected person's blood. The test is not to be confused with the comparatively less expensive and commonly known HIV test that checks for the presence of HIV antibodies in a person's blood. Some viral load tests use a variation of a method called the polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, which is a scientific technique used in molecular biology. The PCR amplifies DNA in order to create a DNA sequence. In short, this can be used to mark and calculate the amount of virus in an infected blood cell. To validate his claims, David Crow points out that the inventor of a method that eventually led to HIV viral load tests is an AIDS denialist as well.
Kerry Mullis, the man who invented PCR, which is behind the viral load test, is what some people call a denialist. He questions whether HIV causes AIDS. He also questions whether a test that was designed, a technique that was designed to manufacture DNA should be used to detect DNA or RNA. They don't actually detect the HIV genome. They detect a very small part of it. And nobody's ever proven that that genome comes from a virus and isn't somehow generated in the body through some other disease process. I mean, basically, in order to validate the PCR or viral load test, you would need to first purify the virus and then analyze its RNA sequence and then use that RNA sequence for your test. But because they've never purified HIV, they couldn't possibly do that.
Brian Foley from the National Institute of Health responds.
Katie Mullis did not invent the viral load test, and I'm not sure exactly who did invent it. There are actually 8 or 10 different types of viral load tests. Katie Mullis has heard of Peter Duisberg, and last I knew, he believed what Peter said and doesn't think that the virus causes AIDS. Well, some viral load tests are based on PCR, but most of them use branched chain DNA testing, and it's accurate. It works. It's not accurate, you know, to, you can't say there's 996 viruses per mil or whatever. It's more on a log scale that you'll say that the viral load is, you know, between 1 and 10 or 10 and 100 or 100 and 1,000, 1,000 and 10,000, and so on. But it's accurate. The viral load doesn't necessarily predict exactly the course of the disease or anything, but it tells you very much how well the drugs are inhibiting the virus.
It's no surprise that Crow invalidates the viral load test, considering he denies the existence of HIV. But what about the detailed scientific research that breaks down how the HIV virus attacks CD4 or T cells? CD4 cells are a subset of white blood cells that play an important role in the body's immune system. The absence of these white blood cells restricts the body's ability to fight basic infections, or what HIV researchers call opportunistic infections. Crow, the president of Rethinking AIDS, denies the existence of HIV and questions peer-reviewed scientific studies on the subject. But what about all the AIDS-diagnosed people who have died over the past few decades due to opportunistic infections? If it wasn't HIV, then what killed their immune system? Here's David Groh's response.
Well, actually, I've done a lot of research into CD4 counts, and there is no explanation of how HIV kills CD4 counts. They rejected, even Robert Gallo rejected the idea that HIV directly kills CD4 counts. Many years ago, and there's never really been an explanation of how HIV kills CD4 counts. And of course, that's critical because HIV is supposed to cause CD4 counts, which causes immune deficiency, which allows the opportunistic infections. So if you haven't proven that HIV causes the depletion of CD4 counts, then you haven't proven that HIV causes AIDS. And you don't need a low CD4 count to be diagnosed with AIDS. So if you get Kaposi's sarcoma, for example, and you're HIV positive, nobody's going to worry about the fact that your CD4 count is over 1,000. They're just going to say, well, that's AIDS. Now, if you have a CD4 count of 200 and a positive HIV test and you're perfectly healthy, they'll say that that's AIDS, but you're not even sick. So CD4 counts are extremely misleading. I don't know if you knew this, but if you smoke, CD4 counts increase when you smoke. So I guess that means that smoking is good for you. Exercise reduces CD4 counts, so I guess that means that exercise is bad for you. The reality is that CD4 counts are a very murky kind of marker. They have some value, but not the rigid value that's assigned by very unimaginative AIDS researchers who want to have a number, 200, 300, 400, 500. Give me a number, and if you're one under, you're dying, and if you're one over, you're okay. You know, like, that doesn't make much sense.
HIV database analyst Brian Foley contends that it's not just about the numbers. According to Foley, there is simply no debate in regards to the impact that HIV has on the body's white blood cells.
The CD4 cells have the receptor that HIV binds to, so that's the cell that HIV will bind to and infect. And then whether the virus directly kills CD4 cells or whether CD8 T killer cells come in and kill the infected cell doesn't make much difference. The end result is that your CD4 plus T cells decline over time. And CD4 plus T cells are called helper T cells. They're not the primary fighters of disease. That's mainly your B cells and your CD8 cells. So you can actually live quite well with very low CD4 cells. People usually don't really see any symptoms of that until their CD4 plus cells drop well under 100 per mil. There are other cells like dendritic cells and macrophages and even neural cells that HIV can infect, but the primary target is the CD4 T cells, and the decline in CD4 T cells as the primary cause of the illness.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, over 600,000 people have died in the United States due to AIDS-related complications since the epidemic began. According to UNAIDS, over 1.8 million people have died globally. If AIDS or HIV had no influence, then how do you explain all of these deaths? Here's David Crow.
Well, I mean, people die all the time, and it's very difficult to explain, you know, thousands of deaths with one simple answer. I mean, the claim is that people who were diagnosed HIV positive, first of all, the claim is they had no other health risks in their life, that they weren't drug abusers, they had not received transfusions, they weren't exposed to chemicals at work. That's the first claim, and in many cases, that's not true. And then there's the psychological impact of an HIV diagnosis. I mean, when you're told by the doctor that you've got a fatal condition, I mean, the first thing you want to do is kill yourself. And many HIV-positive people did that, or they just lost hope. And, there, you know, there's examples in the literature of people dying because they were diagnosed with cancer, but they never actually had cancer, but they died just like a cancer patient because they basically gave up hope. They knew they were going to die, so they did.
Another strong contention between the HIV denialists and the mainstream scientific and medical community is the effectiveness of medications designed to treat people with HIV and or AIDS. If the drugs work as intended, the HIV virus is prevented from destroying the infected person's immune system to the point that they get an AIDS diagnosis, or worse, get an opportunistic infection. Conversely, David Crow believes that AIDS drugs have killed more people over the years than they've saved.
But the leading cause of death has now, amongst people classified as HIV or AIDS, has become liver failure, which has never been an AIDS-defining condition and is a common side effect of these toxic pharmaceuticals. So, you know, given that nobody's ever proven that HIV exists because it's never been purified, the drugs really can't be effective, and they do have significant side effects. Even the most modern drugs, kidney failure is becoming a lot more common, for example, than it used to be. There's just a huge list of side effects from these drugs.
Brian Foley argues that antiviral drugs have come a long way since the start of the epidemic.
The drugs have been very effective after we got what we call highly active antiretroviral therapy, which means taking more than one antiretroviral at a time. A single drug alone, like AZT, was only effective for a few weeks to a few months at prolonging life, but several drugs taken together have raised the life expectancy to near normal now.
One of his contentions against antiviral therapy, he also says that liver failure is now the leading cause of death amongst AIDS patients. Is that a fact?
I'm not sure. In the United States, it could be because a lot of people who die when they're infected with HIV die because of hepatitis C co-infection. So a lot of people are, especially IV drug users that are still dying of AIDS. Number one, they're not getting adequate treatment because they're not insured and whatnot. They're not getting treated early. Number two, they're often co-infected with hepatitis C virus, and it's much more difficult to fight both viruses at once.
David Crow, the president of Rethinking AIDS, denies the existence of HIV and discounts mainstream scientific research on HIV and AIDS. Crow questions the medical establishment that many trust with their lives. That brings up the question of motivation. If we are being hoodwinked, and Crow, along with others in the HIV denialist movement, are right, then the question begs, why? The answer to David Crow is obvious.
AIDS has become a very profitable business. Many AIDS drugs have sales that exceed $1 billion a year. If the alternative was to say that the reason why a very small percentage of gay men got sick in the 1980s was because of excessive drug use, if the reason why people who received blood transfusions for hemophilia in the 1970s and 80s, the reason they got sick was because those transfusions back then were very impure, then there would be nothing for AIDS specialists to do. There would be nothing for pharmaceutical companies to do, and it would cost these companies, these doctors, and the other people who are living very profitable lives off this theory, it would cost them their careers. So there's huge resistance to what's very profitable for them. It's very unfortunate for the people who are taking extremely toxic AIDS drugs and are getting liver failure, kidney failure, living with extreme pain, unable to leave the house because they might have diarrhea at any moment. I mean, those people are the ones who are paying for the profits of the drug companies.
While Brian Foley concedes that profit is an influential factor in America's healthcare system, the HIV database analyst says it's nothing more than a convenient justification for HIV denialist rhetoric.
No, it makes a nice excuse for them to say that things are done only because of that. But that's not true. I mean, the bigger reason that the research got done was the activism of, when HIV was first, well, not HIV, when AIDS was first discovered in the late 1970s, early 1980s, it was thought to be mostly a gay man's disease, and gay men weren't highly regarded, and especially not in medical political circles at the time. But the activism of not only gay men, but also actors and housewives, hemophiliacs, others that eventually got infected, drove a major start in their research.
Tonight, we have heard some controversial views on HIV and AIDS. David Crowe and other members of Rethinking AIDS say they welcome dialogue on the issue. However, some members of AIDS Truth, a website whose aim is to debunk AIDS denialist arguments, told me that, quote, offering time to help threatening propaganda is never productive, close quote. Brian Foley was the only member of AIDS Truth that was willing to come on tonight's program. I asked Brian about the danger of the denialist message.
Yeah, I mean, most individuals would choose to believe that the virus will never hurt them. You know, and that's why, the term denialist came about, was that one of the natural human reactions to any bad news is to deny it. You say, oh, I don't really have cancer. Oh, cancer's not going to hurt me. Or, oh, the HIV test is probably a false positive. I'm not infected. Or only 75% of people who are infected get sick. I'm not going to get sick. I'll be fine without treatment. And people will ignore their treatment, or ignore the diagnosis and not bother to get treated. And over time, we've learned that treatment early is very important. If you wait until you're sick, the treatments are not nearly as likely to save your life as if you get treated early.
Foley went on to talk about the influence of AIDS denialism in South Africa.
Well, in the United States, it's, only killed a few hundred people or so. Some famous ones would be Christine Majori and Carrie Stokely and a few others. But in South Africa, it had a huge impact. They were able to convince the government to not even accept free antiretrovirals for preventing mother-to-infant transmission. They convinced the government to ignore their AIDS problem for a period of about 6 years, and it was a disaster for South Africa, both economically and medically.
According to David Crowe, not nearly as many people have died in South Africa as Foley contends.
Well, they're going to have to revise their estimates because just a few days ago, a report came out from South Africa, and it noted this dramatic difference between the estimates of deaths that are generated in an office in Geneva, Switzerland, by the World Health Organization, or UNAIDS, versus the actual government of South Africa reports of deaths. For example, the government of South Africa reported just over 6,000 deaths from AIDS in 1997 versus UNAIDS reporting 360,000. And in 2008, there were 15,000 reported AIDS deaths in South Africa versus 310,000 by these government agencies. And the world has been gobbling up these huge death estimates, which are nothing but mathematical models, and not looking at the simple truth that the population of South Africa is growing dramatically. So if AIDS is devastating South Africa, where is the evidence on the ground in terms of a diminished population? And why is the government of South Africa, which is there, why are they unable to discover, why are they missing well over 300,000 deaths a year?
Crow is referring to a report produced by Chris Jennings, the principal of a company called Health Alert Communications, which provides writing services to biotechnical, pharmaceutical, and medical product companies. The report claims to have gathered its data from millions of tabulated death notification forms provided by the South African government. The report cautions that its data is, quote, far from perfect. The cause of death was not listed on at least 13% of death notification forms, and only 62% were submitted by medical professionals. The accuracy or even the implications of this report remain to be seen, but it doesn't address the question regarding the deadly implications of what some call AIDS denialism rhetoric. I produce tonight's broadcast because, like David Crow and others from Rethinking AIDS, I do believe in open dialogue on this issue and pretty much any issue that's controversial. Looking at AIDS denialism provides us an opportunity to question our basic understanding of health issues that have a life and death consequence. If you are at risk of contracting HIV, I encourage you to get tested and seek advice from a medical professional. As a producer of Out Loud and a KBOO volunteer, I do not endorse the views that were shared tonight by David Crow. However, being able to hear his viewpoints is one of the things that makes KBOO special.
For the past about half hour, you've been listening to a show from October 18th, 2011, when Rebecca Ney explored the topic of AIDS denialism. You are listening to Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show. We're going to shift gears a bit here and bring in a short clip from a band called Absodo, one of the headliners for the Portland Queer Music Festival, which starts Friday at Crush in Southeast Portland. The name of this song is No Class. We'll be right back.
There go that tacky-ass queen over there with the word classy on her license plate. Bitch, ain't nobody talking to you anyway. This a A-B conversation. You could see your way out. Speaking of class, like school in the summertime, no class.
Class, 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 class.
Your shit is whack, you're so disheveled. My flow is tight, I'm on a whole other level. Your shit is whack, you're so disheveled. My flow is tight.
All right, that's a bit from Absodo. They'll be appearing at the Portland Queer Music Festival at Crush this weekend. Speaking of music, I want to note that it's the birthday of Kate Bush as well as Anita Hill today. You have been listening to Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show. My name is Alan. It's been a pleasure hanging out with you tonight. If you'd like to contact our production team for Out Loud, you can email us at outloudradio@gmail.com. You can also find our Out Loud Radio page on Facebook, and we'd love it if you would friend us. We're always looking for content suggestions and especially volunteers to help us produce this radio program. Coming up next is This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian News Magazine. Tonight, we'll hear about ongoing actions related to LGBT equality in Russia, Zimbabwe, and Lithuania, among other places. So until next week, stay proud and live out loud.
What has Putin got to gain from war on homosexuals? Oh, we won't look at what else he's doing and how he's failing and what's going on with their economy and everything else in that country.
I have the feeling that no one cares about what happened, and I'm afraid that this crime, horrible crime, will stay unpunished.
They made Zimbabweans to think as if when you're talking about gays and lesbians, you are maybe probably talking about whether you want it or not.
Welcome to This Way Out,
the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Russian repression threatens the Olympic torch. Cameroon activists mourn an assassinated leader. And an update on Zimbabwe's long, hard slog against AIDS. More stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Tanya King Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 27th, 2013. LGBT news this week was dominated by several stories in or about Vladimir Putin's Russia. It began with venerable playwright, actor, activist Harvey Fierstein assailing what he called the Russian president's pogrom against gay people in a New York Times op-ed column. More about that later in the program. Meanwhile, the leader of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill I, told congregants in Moscow's Kazan Cathedral that recognizing same-gender relationships means that people are choosing a path of self-destruction. He also called marriage equality a very dangerous sign of the apocalypse.
An appeals court in St. Petersburg upheld a backbreaking fine this week against the city's side-by-side LGBT film festival. Organizers denied violating a newly enacted Russian regulation that requires non-governmental organizations to report funding they get from abroad. They said they hadn't received any such funding, but the group was convicted under the new law of failing to register as a foreign agent. The judge did reduce the fine from 500,000 rubles to 400,000 rubles, but that's still more than $12,000.
A notorious neo-Nazi group has been using the Russian version of Facebook to lure young gay men to what they think is a date, only to be tortured, beaten, and forced to come out to friends and family as video cameras roll. The group, which claims to be acting against pedophilia, has even boastfully posted photos and videos of some particularly cruel sessions online. According to the Spectrum Human Rights Alliance, which publicized the situation this week, many young victims of the videotaped assaults have been driven to suicides, the rest deeply traumatized, and authorities are either ignoring or condoning the crimes.
Four Dutch nationals were arrested in northern Russia this week for allegedly violating the new law recently signed by President Putin that bans the promotion of non-traditional sexual relations. Russian immigration officials charged the group with violating its stated reason for being in the country, getting acquainted with local culture, when in fact they were filming a documentary about LGBT life in the town of Murmansk. Authorities seized the filmmaker's footage, alleging that a gay teenager interviewed by the team was only 17. But the filmmakers, one of whom leads a Dutch LGBT rights group, told the BBC that the young man in question told them that he was 18 when he agreed to be filmed. The visitors were each fined 3,000 rubles for violating the terms of their visa. That's about $93, and also banned from entering the country again for 3 years. They're believed to be the first non-Russians to be punished by the country's so-called no-promo-homo law.
The U.S. LGBT advocacy group Human Rights Campaign has urged the chief executive officer of NBC Universal, which will broadcast the Winter Olympics in the Russian Black Sea town of Sochi next year, to expose this inhumane and unjust law to the millions of American viewers who will tune in to watch the games. You no doubt agree, wrote HRC President Chad Griffin, that it wouldn't be right to air the opening ceremonies, which is an hours-long advertisement for the host country, without acknowledging that a whole segment of the Russian population, not to mention foreign athletes and visitors, can be jailed for an immutable aspect of their identity. NBC Universal told BuzzFeed that it strongly supports equal rights and the fair treatment for all people, but HRC called that response platitudes that won't do away with these heinous laws. And as Andrew Belonsky wrote in The Advocate, there's no way NBC will be able to avoid covering the protests already being organized. One way or another, Putin will be shamed. NBC Universal can either go along willingly or find itself being caught from behind. The HRC also questioned a statement issued later in the week by the International Olympic Committee that it has received assurances from the highest level of government in Russia that the legislation will not affect those attending or taking part in the games. Mere verbal assurances are not enough, the rights group said. The IOC must obtain ironclad written assurance from President Putin.
A gay night spot in Chicago may have been the first such establishment to stop serving Russian vodka. the two best known of which are Russian Standard and Stolichnaya, or Stoli. The idea to use the pocketbook to protest increasing Russian persecution of LGBT people picked up steam when a column by activist writer Dan Savage calling for a boycott of all Russian vodka went viral. The boycott has already spread to other bars in Chicago and to gay night spots in other cities around the world, including San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, Seattle, San Diego, London, Toronto, and Vancouver. Stolichnaya's corporate owners, Luxembourg-based SPI Group, though some insist that the Russian government also has a hand in management, released an open letter this week from CEO Val Mendeleev, insisting that, as a company that encourages transparency and fairness, we are upset and angry about the new laws. Stolichnaya Vodka has always been and continues to be a fervent supporter and friend to the LGBT community. Leading Russian activist Nikolai Alexeyev opposes the boycott of Russian vodka. What is the aim of this boycott? He asked during an interview with Gay Star News. The producers, even if they become bankrupt because of the boycott, which is unlikely, will not be able to influence Russian politics and President Putin.
Elsewhere, lawmakers in the former Soviet nation of Moldova have secretly enacted their own version of Russia's no-promo homo law. The revelation this week that the measure passed on May 23rd, was signed into law by President Nikolai Timofti on July 5th, and took effect with its publication on July 12th, surprised LGBT activists and their allies, because it seems to run counter to the ruling coalition government's stated goal of having Moldova join the European Union. The new law specifies fines of up to 8,000 leu, about $625, for the distribution of public information aimed at the propagation of prostitution, pedophilia, pornography, or of any other intimate relations other than those related to marriage or family. Angela Frolov leads the LGBT rights group GenderDocM in the Moldovan capital of Chișinău. She said that her group and several others internationally believe that the new law contradicts the constitution and Moldovan law, especially the EU-backed anti-discrimination law and some international treaties that Moldova has signed.
Hundreds of extremists in the southeastern European nation of Montenegro chanted, "Kill the gays," and threw stones and bottles at the country's first LGBT pride parade on July 24th. About 120 outnumbered equality supporters suffered the assault in the seaside city of Budva, although police intervened to separate the peaceful pride marchers and their violent opponents. There were several injuries, though none were reported as serious, and some of the protesters were arrested.
A heavy police presence protected Lithuania's second-ever LGBT pride parade in the capital city of Vilnius from egg-throwing protesters on July 27th. The Associated Press reported that hundreds of equality activists waved Lithuanian and rainbow flags in the parade, some standing on tops of buses decked out in colorful balloons. Sweden's European Union Affairs Minister Birgitta Olsen, who marched at the front of the parade with other dignitaries, was among those pelted with eggs. Police said that one officer was injured in confrontations with the protesters and that 28 were arrested. A local court okayed the march after city officials tried to stop it from going forward.
In other news, an effort to make South Australia the first state in Australia to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples failed this week. Several opponents argued that marriage in Australia is governed by federal law. Isabel Redman, a prominent member of the Liberal opposition, said that trying to enact marriage equality at the state level was nothing but an attempt to politicize something which can't be decided by this parliament. Even though Labour Party Premier Jay Weatherill strongly supported the proposal, only 19 of the lower house's 47 MPs voted for it. A similar bill is pending in South Australia's upper house.
Meanwhile, New Mexico Attorney General Gary King told the Supreme Court in his U.S. state this week that any effort to ban marriage equality is unconstitutional. A gay couple in Santa Fe has gone directly to the state high court demanding the right to civil marriage. King wrote in the legal filing that New Mexico's guarantee of equal protection to its citizens demands that same-sex couples be permitted to enjoy the benefits of marriage in the same way and to the same extent as other New Mexico citizens.
And finally, the Super Mario Brothers of the famed Nintendo game are actually a gay couple. According to a story published in mid-July by the Spanish-language website Ciencia Seminal, children under the age of 10 assume that Luigi and Mario are a gay couple rather than brothers. A follow-up story quoted the game's creator, Shigeru Miyamoto, as saying, That was the original intention of the game. It was a game charged with the signs of gay culture, and Luigi and Mario were a gay couple trying to brave a society that rejects them. Ciencia Semanal also reported that the flagpoles at the end of each level in Super Mario Bros. Were deliberate phallic symbols, and that the Goomba enemies in the game were supposed to represent testicles. There's just one problem. Ciencia Semanal is a satirical Spanish language website akin to the English language Onion. Despite being posted alongside other headlines like Internet police assure that false information on the web is near zero, the story was reported as serious news this week in Mexico and several Central American and South American countries.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 27th, 2013. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced by Steve Pride.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
It's becoming de rigueur in the media to tisk, tisk, tisk anti-LGBT actions in the third world. But before we look at the latest homophobic horrors on the African continent, we turn our attention to alarming developments in the heart of the second world. It took a New York Times op-ed piece by the multi-award-winning playwright-performer-activist Harvey Fierstein this week to put the spotlight on Russia's fierce crackdown on LGBT rights. President Vladimir Putin recently signed laws banning LGBT-positive speech and adoptions of Russian children by parents from marriage-equality countries, and more repressive laws are said to be in the works. Shocking violence against gays and lesbians and their allies is clearly on the rise. Fierstein took his dire warning to Lawrence O'Donnell's The Last Word on MSNBC.
What has Putin got to gain from war on homosexuals? Oh, we won't look at what else he's doing and how he's failing and what's going on with their economy and everything else in that country.
You compare it to the Nazi playbook. You say Mr. Putin's campaign against lesbian, gay, and bisexual people is one of distraction. It's a campaign of distraction, a strategy of demonizing a minority for political gain taken straight out of the Nazi playbook.
Well, and isn't that what the conservatives are doing to the homosexuals in the United States? I mean, it's the same thing. Who is it in Virginia that's running for governor of Virginia? He now wants to.
Cuccinelli, yeah.
Cuccinelli now wants to bring back the laws saying that even married couples cannot have oral sex.
Mm-hmm. Your piece contains a warning. The Olympics coming up, Winter Olympics coming up in Russia, and your piece contains a warning for tourists who might be going there for the Olympics.
Well, four Dutch tourists were arrested the other day. I think one of them had a rainbow a pattern on the T-shirt, and the four of them were arrested. It's not that you're gay. It's not that they even think that you're gay. If you say something pro-gay, mm-hmm. if a teacher says to a student, there is another way of living, you get fined. If a newscaster reports this story in a positive way towards mm-hmm. gay, you can be fined. It's horrendous. I get messages even from gay people in Russia, you know, thanks to Facebook and, mm-hmm. and tweets and all that, saying, well, we're fine and all that. And I say, you know, having grown up with people with numbers tattooed on their arms, yeah. there's something that just gets me when people say, oh, we're just fine and all that. I mean, I had family members that thought it was just fine to stay in Germany at those times. There is a war. Declared against us. Somebody's willing to put you in jail because of who you are or what you think. Mm-hmm. And the only way to get back at people like that is take the money away. You have to starve the rat out. Putin is a rat, and you have to starve him out. You know, don't put billions of the world's money into Russia for the Olympics. You know, take the Olympics somewhere else. That's my feeling. My feeling is we should boycott the Olympics.
Harvey Fierstein's call on Lawrence O'Donnell's MSNBC program for a boycott of the 2014 Winter Olympics in the Russian city of Sochi is indeed being discussed in some quarters. Considering such an action is controversial, just as it was in 1936
when Nazi Germany hosted the Games. Boycott opponents now make similar arguments as were made then. They say the chance to spotlight the host country's discriminatory policies on its own ground beats staying home in silence. Gay U.S. figure skater Johnny Weir says that no police officer or government will keep him from competing. Gay New Zealand speed skater Blake Skellerup plans to wear a rainbow pin when he competes in Sochi. A New York-based LGBT Russian expatriate group led by Yelena Goltzman is manufacturing rainbow pins for Olympics-bound athletes, but she's encouraging a spectator boycott. Human Rights Watch LGBT Advocacy Director Boris Dietrich, however, is against any boycott. He believes that no one who supports LGBT equality is safe in Russia, and that it would be a stronger stand for the International Olympic Committee to demand that the anti-gay laws not be enforced at all. We'll, of course, continue to follow this story.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
Dangers loom heavily over the heads of African LGBT activists, with Cameroon and Zimbabwe as two particularly critical hotspots. Free Speech Radio News feature reports from both countries this week, starting with coverage of the murder of Eric Lembembe, executive director of the Cameroonian human rights group CAMFAIDS. N'Gali Killian Chimtom has more from Yaoundé.
When Eric Lembembe didn't answer his phone, his partner Frederick Mveng thought something might be wrong.
When we arrived at Eric's house, the door was still locked, but we started to notice the stench, so the friend I was with tried to open the windows to find out where the stench was coming from.
Mveng never expected what he saw next.
After forcing open the windows, I saw his feet. At first, I didn't believe what I was seeing. I turned and told Michelle that Eric was inside. He surely died Friday night or early Saturday, but we only got there on Monday.
Lembembe was a prominent gay rights activist and journalist. He frequently published reports and blog posts exposing threats, attacks and intimidation of the LGBT community, while also campaigning for equality and human rights. He recently pushed for an investigation into an arson and break-in in the offices of human rights groups. He wrote, quote, "Unfortunately, a climate of hatred and bigotry in Cameroon, which extends to high levels in government, reassures homophobes that they can get away with these crimes."
I feel shocked. I'm really traumatized by this terrific news of the assassination of my son Eric. And of course, I'm afraid too.
Gay rights lawyer Alison Combe was so close to Lembembe she called him her son. As head of the Cameroon Association for the Defense of Homosexuality, Combe says his killing is part of a wider campaign of violence and intimidation against LGBT people.
Madame Maximilienne Gombe, who has been aggressed a lot of time, and daughters have been raped many times for what she's doing. And now this assassination, this is just so bad.
Combe suggests Lembembe was targeted not only because he was gay, but for his activism.
Eric was a very, very nice person working in this area of sexual minorities defense. He was a journalist. He used to convey our messages to media and to people worldwide. I read his last article when he was reporting on what happened to Alternative when they put fire in the center in Douala. And I think that this is why he was killed.
Human rights defenders in Cameroon and across the globe are condemning the killing. Saskia de Tichem, the president of Lawyers Without Borders based in Switzerland, has worked with gay rights advocates in Cameroon. She says she will do everything within her power to bring the culprits to justice.
I'm appalled, very, very shocked. And I hope this is a wrong feeling. There will be no prosecution. I have the feeling that no one cares about what happened. And I'm afraid that this crime, horrible crime, will stay unpunished. And I will do everything in my power to help to find the authors of this horrible crime.
Getting justice for gays in Cameroon is not going to be easy. The country's penal code punishes gays or people suspected of being gays with prison terms of up to 5 years. In the government's first public response to the killing, a spokesperson lashed out at the media and threatened journalists that they'd be breaking the law for any interference or untruthfulness. But pressure is building. The governments of the United States, France, and the United Kingdom have condemned the killing, and the United Nations has called for an investigation into Lebembe's murder. Ngala Kilian Chimtom, FSRN, Yaounde, Cameroon.
Zimbabwe activists have been engaged in a struggle for LGBT rights for decades. Garikai Chaunza of Free Speech Radio News has the latest from Harare.
Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe has fueled prejudice against LGBT people through public statements that endorse discrimination and stigmatization. He has on several occasions described gays as being worse than pigs and dogs, but the discrimination is not limited to public discourse. The country's common laws prohibit sodomy and define it as the unlawful and intentional sexual relations between two males. According to the Gays and Lesbian of Zimbabwe, the criminal law explicitly prohibits consensual sex between adult men but can be applied to any semi-gender couple and includes penalties of fines and even prison. Tonerai Batasara works with the organization Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights. He explains how the law is applied.
You see, the specific offense is that of sodomy, and it has to be distinguished from being you need to have committed the specific offense of sodomy for you to have contravened the law. It will not be enough just for you to be a gay man or a homosexual man.
Batasara has represented the advocacy group Gays and Lesbians of Zimbabwe, or GALS, on several occasions after members were arrested and harassed by the state. One of those is the group's director, Chesterfield Samba. He was at one point picked up from his office, searched and taken to Harare Central Police Station. He was not formally charged before being released. Other GALS members and officials have over the years been raided, arrested and harassed by the police before being freed without charges. Samba says the climate of attacks and repression continues because few are lobbying for equality in the country.
I think the situation that needs to prevail in the country is a situation where everybody speaks to the notion around equality for everyone, regardless of sexual orientation or any other difference whatsoever. And I think that's the position in which so many civil society organizations that try and lobby for human rights, they try and speak on a platform around equality for everybody and human rights for all.
Samba and GALS attempted to gain protections for LGBT people last year during the process of the drafting of a new constitution. The issue sparked debates and even temporarily stopped the process after President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF party accused the Morgan Tsvangirai-led MDC of trying to smuggle gay rights in the supreme law of the land. But Samba says they simply want the same protections as everyone else.
Our submission was premised on three issues: the right to privacy, right to equality and non-discrimination, as well as the right to dignity. You'll find that those three elements are now part of the new constitution that we now ushered in as a country. I think where the politicians expressed concerns was around the issue of same-sex marriage, which really wasn't our submission.
The National Constitutional Assembly, or NCA, is a grassroots NGO that formed 15 years ago to help advance human rights in civic issues. The group's spokesperson, Madok Shivasa, says that the recent constitution-making process left out a number of fundamental issues and groups.
The problem with the constitution-making process was also that it was sidelining a lot of people. It would be very difficult for those people in political power to understand them, because these are the people who actually brought the polarization that came when you want to understand the existence of this grouping in Zimbabwe. They made Zimbabweans to think as if when you are talking about gays and lesbians, you are maybe probably talking about whether you want it or not. The issue was for people of Zimbabwe to discuss about the existence of these people and to discuss about, so what can we do about their existence?
The majority of Zimbabweans are Christian, and many faith leaders preach homophobia. Even some of those who disagree with political statements on LGBT issues believe the myth that sexual orientation is a choice. Jairus Masango is a local pastor in Harare.
The bedrock of Christian life is understanding and tolerance. So the way I see it is we should try to look things from their point of view. Try to understand, you know, really what drove them into homosexuality. I would think the only solution is not to fight, it's not to attack them, but rather to pray for them.
U.S.-based evangelical groups have also advanced anti-gay campaigns in the country. Although there may be a lack of condemnation of the discrimination and abuses within the country, United Nations Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay challenged Zimbabwe politicians against attacking homosexuals during a visit last year.
There can be no justification for violence, harassment, or stigmatization. And criminalization of any group because of their sexual orientation can lead to impediments to their accessing basic services. In other words, result in clear-cut discrimination, including treatment for HIV.
While campaigning recently in front of thousands of supporters, President Mugabe again made anti-gay statements suggesting the jailing of LGBT people who did not have children, according to New Zimbabwe News. Human rights advocates are calling on Mugabe to immediately cease making statements that vilify or dehumanize the LGBT community. Karikai Chaunza, FSRN, Harare.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Christopher Gall and Tanya Kane Perry contributed program material. Thanks also to Free Speech Radio News and to Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is funded by the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, and our loyal listener supporters. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org for news about our latest exploits and for links to our podcast, blog, and Facebook page. You can also hear This Way Out on iTunes. Follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email TWO.